Hello and welcome to an exciting episode of Politics War Room with guest host Paul Begala. And I am Al Hunt. James will be back next week with exciting stories, so stay tuned. This week, our guest is President and Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley School of Law, Mark Udoff. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom at gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now we'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. So please check out the links to our sponsors, Ladder, Kalshi, and Total Gym, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. Now please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. I just want to tell our listeners, James Carville is doing his Walter Lippmann traveling around, visiting world capitals, Europe last week, Asia this week. So we'll get a full report, global report next week. We have as good a guest as James, Paul Begala, since for more than 30 years they have been joined at the political hip. And so we can't thank you enough, Paul, for filling in today.
Yeah, actually, thank you, Al. It's a great honor. I love this podcast. It's been 40 years. It's a 40th year Carville and I have been together. And I always tell people being James Carville's partner, a little bit like being Kim Kardashian's feet. And I'm sure they're very nice, but they get overshadowed by more prominent features. That has been my lot in life for all of my adult life. And I gladly stand in Carville's shadow.
Paul, I said more than 30 because I thought we wanted to forget the first one or two that you might have lost.
We were pretty pathetic before.
You had a pretty darn good win streak, though. Let's talk about Donald Trump, which unfortunately we have to do most weeks. I actually have been following this trial more carefully than I thought I would. I thought I'd watch the first day and that's it. And I don't watch, you know, there's not much to watch on CNN, although some of the reports have actually been pretty good. But it may well be that Michael Cohen is a terrible prosecution witness. It may be there's a hung jury. They complain that Manhattan is 87% Democratic. Okay, it's 12% non-Democratic. Only takes one juror. So I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to pretend that I do. But one thing after 2 weeks is abundantly clear. Ms. Daniels and Ms. McDougal, both of whom claim to have a sexual relationship with Donald Trump, were paid off shortly before the 2016 election, after the Access Hollywood tape came out when he bragged about sexually accusing women. There is no doubt they were paid off because they thought it would hurt the campaign if it came out. That, it seems to me, is clear-cut from the witnesses we've heard so far. There is no doubt that Trump cooked the books to make it appear that it was a legal expense, pure and simple. That doesn't mean he's going to be adjudged guilty. I don't know what will happen there, but at least those two things, I think, are abundantly clear. But, Paul, I was in many ways more focused on the interview he gave Time because it was anything new, but it was all in Trump's words. And he tells you, he lays out exactly what a second term would be. He said, I'm no longer going to be a nice guy. You probably didn't know he was a nice guy back in the first term. But I think it's telling. He's going to be an authoritarian with few checks or balances. He'd use the military for domestic political purposes, round up and have massive deportations, gut the civil service. It would be something like America has never seen. And as I say, I don't think it was terribly new. We knew it all along, but it's in his own words.
It is still amazing that Mr. Trump retains the capacity to shock, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
You know, how many years, 8 years since he slithered down the escalator? And yet I was shocked too. You read that interview, I will give him this. He is being transparent about his goals. And, you know, it's one thing if you think taxes should go up or down or change this law or that. He is talking really about, in no way in the state, ending the democracy as we know it. Using the judicial system to prosecute his critics, cracking down on media, incarcerating and deporting 10 or 11 million people. I mean, it really does boggle the mind. For me, the worst thing, the most frightening thing, as these campuses are exploding, is his desire to invoke the Insurrection Act. Insurrection Act passed in 1792 because General Washington needed the power to put down rebellions because the colonists were still rebelling even after they got their own country. So Shays' rebellion is going on. Washington goes to Congress, says, I need the right to put these down. And they give him that right. Over the years, that right to take law, to take troops and put down an insurrection been used by Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson to enforce integration. Last used by George H.W. Bush in the aftermath of the L.A. riots. And I was working for Governor Bill Clinton. We went out to the site of those riots. And my recollection is Governor Clinton endorsed President Bush invoking the insurrection because we needed order. We needed peace. We needed to stop the riot. This is not what Trump will use it for. He's not going to, I really worry. You read that article, you see a man who wants to take military force and use it against American citizens. And I'm desperately worried that he'll do that.
With just cause, because traditionally, as you say, we have not used the military for domestic purposes. He has no inhibitions about that. And I think, look, James and I'm not quite sure where you were, Paul, but James and I did not want Biden to run. We thought it was a big mistake. We argued rather strenuously, and it shows you what great clout we had. But he is running. He is the candidate. And I wish he hadn't. I worry some about a second term. I will never cast an easier vote in my life. Because if you look at the dangers, you look at just read that Time magazine article, remember some other things. It's very possible Biden will have two or three Supreme Court appointments, or Trump will have two or three Supreme Court appointments the next term. How would you like to have, you know, some more Sam Alitos and some more Brett Kavanaughs? And, I just think it's frightening. I just say one more thing, Paul, because you know more about this than I do. If Trump wins, the Senate's gone. There's just no question about that. I think it's possible to hold on to the Senate uphill if Biden can win by 3 or 4, possible. But I think the last hope is the House. I think there's a better chance of holding the House, even with a Trump win. And I hope some of these Democratic donors realize that there may not be the big names, the glitterati for House races. But boy, there are about a dozen House races that they ought to be focused on heavily.
I think they are. I think both grassroots donors who give online and also some of these big donors, I think they're very focused on it. And shout out to Hakeem Jeffries. You know, you and I are sports fans. They always say, you don't want to be the coach who follows the legend.
Right.
You know, you don't want to follow Nick Saban, right?
Right.
And Hakeem is following, I think, the greatest speaker in American history. And yet he's doing a great job. His party is organized. They're focused on these key House races. They only need to pick up a small handful, mostly in New York and California. Hakeem being from New York. So, yes, I think that's right. I think that if Trump wins, he does take the Senate with him. And then the Democrats do, under Jeffries, have a real shot at taking back the House. And that might I'd still rather have Biden's problems than Trump's. Even though if the election were held today, I think Trump wins. I'd still rather have Biden's problems than Trump's because Biden has a problem with his base. Trump, God knows, has no problem with his base. They'll go to jail for him. But Trump can't reach out to those swing voters. And Biden has been very successful in reaching out to independents and moderate Republicans. So can he get his base back? I think he can. I don't like having a problem with my base if I'm a Democrat. But I think that's a more curable problem than Trump's problem. I'm still cautiously optimistic about Biden, but I'm really bullish on Hakeem Jeffries.
Oh, you know, he's been, everything you say, he's been fabulous. And I'll tell you what, he had the good fortune, as Nancy Pelosi did, to be the minority leader first. It would have been much harder if he had started off as, it just is. There's all kinds of other countervailing pressures, but you kind of get your, you know, you get your sea legs if you're a minority leader, and he has been superb. His timing is perfect. I said last week, people, I can't believe all these columns writing about what's Chip Roy going to do or Jim Jordan going to do on Mike Johnson. The only person that matters is Hakeem Jeffries. And I'm sure he will do it skillfully. Well, I pick up on any of that, but let me ask you one question, Paul, because you are such a political expert. I look at North Carolina, and you would say in a close race, North Carolina only one time in the last, what, 8 or 10 presidential elections has gone Democratic. And I would say not much hope. Do you believe in reverse coattails? Because I think it's possible once North Carolinians learn about their statewide candidates who are insane. I mean, they aren't conservative. They're crazy. One of them wants to have a public execution of Barack Obama at Guantanamo. Is there such a thing as reverse coattails?
Look, as a general matter, no. If I'm running Biden's campaign, would I spend time and money in North Carolina? Yes. Yes. Because of all of that. And because it always is for the Democrats, Lucy and the football. God bless Barack Obama. He carried it once. But otherwise, Bill Clinton, you know, a pretty good politician and a Southerner of that, carried a bunch of Southern states, couldn't crack the code. But I think North Carolina is following Virginia and Georgia, a Southern state that has become a swing state. I would definitely go in there. By the way, I would also take $75 million and set it on fire in Florida if I'm running Biden's campaign. Biden has more money and more time than Trump. Right, he's raised much more money. Jeffrey Katzenberg is co-chair, is the best fundraiser I've ever seen. And he's got time because he's not manacled to a courtroom in Manhattan. And I don't think Biden can win Florida, but he might be able to knock off Rick Scott, the vulnerable Republican senator down there. The Democrats have a good candidate, Debbie McCasel Powell. So if you put money into Florida and you're Biden, you're going to draw Trump's money away from Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, where the real action is. But yes, I would definitely, but I'd go and campaign in addition to spending money. I'd campaign in North Carolina because that is the direction the Republican Party under Trump seems to be going toward.
You're right. You're totally right. But Mark Robinson and the others are, they're beyond MAGA right wingers. They are just totally crazy. And I know North Carolina pretty well, as you know, and they've elected some very conservative Republicans, but nothing like this.
Nothing. And look, we saw this happen in Arizona.
Right.
A state that was impregnable for the Democrats in a presidential election. They'd occasionally, Janet Napolitano, some others would win a governorship there, uniquely talented. But that was a given that Arizona would go Republican. It was a party not only of Barry Goldwater, but in more recently of John McCain. Mm-hmm. And those McCain Republicans made Arizona really solidly red. Trump came in and blew the whole thing up. And now you have a Mark Kelly, a Democratic senator. You have a Katie Hobbs, a Democratic governor, a Democratic attorney general. And Republicans have allowed Trump to destroy the Republican Party in Arizona. I think they're doing the same thing in North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah. No, I do too. One person we haven't mentioned in this conversation is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Now, Paul, I must say I am conflicted. James and we haven't argued over this because neither one of us is very confident of our position on this. I generally think that RFK hurts Biden more than Trump. James has come around to thinking he probably hurts Trump a little bit more. I think the two arguments are kind of simple. If you look at the polling, and when you go from two-way to a three-way, and 80% of the time it hurts Biden more. I mean, you just see that, you know, looking at the real clear polling. On the other hand, I think if Robert F. Kennedy is at 11 or 12 and he goes down to 5 or 6 or 7, which I think he probably will, where do those, who's he losing? And my guess is he's losing, you know, disenchanted Democrats and independents who really don't want to go Trump. And I think if they go anywhere, they're more likely to go Biden. So those are the two arguments. Where do you come down?
Yeah, but we mentioned that I've been partners with James for 40 years. We talk every single day. And we've never had an argument about money, not in 40 years, but we often have arguments about strategy, and this is one of them. I am convinced that Bobby Kennedy's candidacy could torpedo Trump. I mean, could torpedo Joe Biden. I'm convinced. Even though the data are more on Carville's side, because right now it does look like Bobby's going to hurt Donald Trump more. And Carville's argument, as you know, is, look, if you just want to blow the whole thing up, and you're anti-vax and anti-everything, you're much more of a Trump type. I disagree. I think the name is so golden and it's so powerful. I mean, you know the Kennedy family, Al. Honey Fitz, Bobby's great-grandfather, gets elected to the Common Council of Boston in 1891. In the ensuing—
I did not cover that, Paul.
You did? I was a deputy press secretary in that race.
youth for Fitzgerald, right?
But 133 years, the Kennedy family has given everything to the country and the Democratic Party. And so that is such a deep affinity. So I think there are Democrats. By the way, there are Democrats who are vaccine skeptics. Frankly, if I was black, I might be one too, given the
history,
obscene history of Americans murdering black men in the Tuskegee syphilis experience. So I think there are a lot of liberals who are anti-vax, like Bobby is. I think there are a lot of liberals who just love the Kennedy name and the Kennedy family, just not going to believe, you know, that he's in this to croak Biden. I think he is. I think his mission, you've had a few aides and he fired them, but a few aides who have basically said, our job is to stop Biden and elect Trump.
Right.
And he does say he's fending that off, but I think he is a heat-seeking missile for Joe Biden and his supporters, because Biden's, as I said, Biden's base is fractious and Trump's base is solid. So I think apparently gained ballot access in Michigan, one of the most important swing states. He's now claiming that he's going to be on in California, in George Wallace's old party, the American Independent Party. In Michigan, he got on via the Natural Law Party, which was the party of transcendental meditation. Not sure where the Kennedys are on that. They generally seem to be Irish Catholics to me, but what the hell? So I'm terribly worried. And I say, I hope James is right, but I fear that he's wrong. That this
Biden. I am closer to your view. But by the way, I talk to James every day since our famous 1992 confrontational phone call on Clinton. So mine is only 32 years, and we rarely miss it. The only disagreement, other than sports, we do disagree on sports. We did disagree on Obama and Hillary in 2008. I think you would have been on his side, but they are rare. I think the Kennedy family, most of the Kennedy family, is just mortified by what Bobby's doing. It's still a magical name. There aren't very many figures left. I think young Joe Kennedy, even though he lost the Senate race, is very effective out there on the stump. He's going to be out there a lot. And I will predict in the fall you're going to see Caroline Kennedy come back from Australia and appear with Joe Biden in several public appearances. And I think President Kennedy's daughter with President Biden, if that happens, I think that will send a message to some of the people you're talking about.
I hope so. She Caroline's been very successful ambassador in Canberra and before that in Tokyo. And so I sort of hate to lose her on behalf of the United States, but there's maybe nothing more.
I'm not saying she'll leave that job. You're allowed to come. You're allowed to take a leave as ambassador for a short time, I believe. And, Rahm Emanuel wouldn't do it, but Caroline Kennedy might do it. Or maybe she leaves. Who knows? In any event, I'm afraid you're more right than James here, so let's just see how it plays out.
But people need to get the message that a vote for Kennedy is a vote for Trump. And I will say this. I like to criticize my party because it's often worthy of criticism. The Democrats have deployed Liz Smith on this project. Liz was the top strategist for Pete Buttigieg. She's a killer. Nobody tougher, nobody smarter. And she has taken the point for the Democratic Party in busting this myth that somehow Bobby Kennedy is a true Democrat, a Kennedy Democrat.
She's also a new mother. And but that has not taken any of the edge off Liz
She's
Smith.
Terrific.
Hey, you know, Ladder makes life insurance quick and easy.
Well, it's peace of mind. It's everything. You know, I know for a fact two things are going to happen when I die. My wife will be cared for and Carvel will hit on her at the funeral. You look good in black, Diane.
but she will say, I'm sorry, I don't like Louisiana guys. I stick with Texas.
But yes, to have that peace of mind, to know that your family will be provided for is really, it's for me, it's essential.
You know, we all have a certain tendency to put things off until the very last minute. You know, filing a story, pushing the candidate over the threshold, or spring cleaning. Most of the time, you can pull it off. But one thing in life that you really can't afford to wait on is setting up term coverage life insurance. The peace of mind, as Paul noted, you get from knowing you've done everything you can for your family relieves anxiety. The unthinkable, unfortunately, can happen, and life is so much better when your loved ones are provided for. Now, you've probably seen life insurance commercials on TV and thought, yeah, I'll look into that later. No. Nobody knows what the next day will bring. I'm not trying to scare anyone, but we still remember 2016. So you need to recognize that this isn't something you can wait on. Now is the time to choose life insurance through Ladder today. It's so convenient. Ladder is 100% digital, no doctors, no needles, no paperwork when you apply for $3 million in coverage or less. All you have to do is answer a few questions about your health on an application. Ladder's customers rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot, and they made Forbes' Best Life Insurance 2021 list. You just need a few minutes and a phone or laptop to apply. Ladder's smart algorithms work in real time, so you'll find if you're instantly approved. There's no uncertainty. There's no hidden fees. You can cancel anytime and get a full refund if you change your mind in the first 30 days. Ladder policies are issued by insurers with long proven histories of paying claims, and they're rated A and A+ by AM Best. Finally, remember something that a few of the people we know found out the hard way. Life insurance costs more as you age. This means now's the time to cross it off your list. Don't let life or this opportunity pass you by. Go to ladderlife.com/war room today to see if you're instantly approved. That's LADDER life.com/war room. Again, ladderlife.com/war room. You also can find the link in our show notes. Hey, we have former head of the whole University of California system and chancellor of the University of Texas and the leader of the Academic Engagement Network, which combats anti-Semitism, particularly on college campuses. And he is an expert on constitutional law and free speech. Professor, we're so pleased to have you. I don't want to be too long on this, but my North Star on free speech goes back to Justice Brandeis almost a century ago, who said speech should only be banned if it is intended or likely to cause imminent violence. And I believe that should be a lodestar, not just for public places, but for universities too, although it's not acceptable to shout down speakers. Therefore, campus demonstrations, even if offensive, whether you agree or not, should be protected speech. However, there have been some clear elements of anti-Semitism tolerated. How do you square all this, and how are most universities doing?
Well, you know, my position, similar to the quotation you gave, is there's no exception for hate speech in the First Amendment. So I start there. But you do have to remember there's perjury, right? That's not necessarily a threat of violence. There's false and misleading advertising. I say to my friend Bagala, your money or your life. He reports me to the police. And I say, I was just expressing my opinion of Bagala. It is his money or his life. I don't like the SOB. And, you know, so you're taking it in. It doesn't apply to all these contexts. And if you're intimidating someone, if you're threatening someone, and there's Title VI, which is in some tension with the First Amendment, that if you create a hostile climate for African-American students, for Jewish students, for Muslim students, or whomever, it is the case the universities may be liable for that. So much of what we do in life involves a mixture of speech and action. And so therefore, if you're roaring into a building, if you're not allowing Jewish students to cross the quad, if you're threatening, and the like, there are real threats which are not constitutionally protected. So there's a whole range of things that involve some speech, but involve a lot of other things as well. And that's when you are entitled to address it without violating someone's constitutional rights. It's also the case, by the way, that private universities are not strictly bound by the First Amendment.
Right.
So that's another sort of side point to making about this, although I admire their dedication. I'm a free speech zealot. I'm just not in favor of a hostile campus climate, and I'm not in favor of occupying libraries and shouting at people, blocking their way into buildings, shouting down speakers. None of that is constitutionally protected.
I think you went to the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I teach a course at your alma mater, not the law school, the undergraduate. And so I've had long conversations with a really interesting collection of students. And here's, you know, basically what I get. There are 7 or 8 Jewish students in the class, self-identified, who say they feel threatened or would feel threatened if they went to Columbia. Not so much at Penn, which went through its trauma in the fall when the university president was kicked out for, I think, dubious reasons. But they also, there's an overwhelming consensus in Jewish and non-Jewish students that what's going on in Gaza is terrible. And they think it's a mistake, as some like your friend Larry Summers advocates, to send in massive force. So that kind of capsulizes the conflict there. They want protection from anti-Semitism. They don't want to impede on free speech, and they think sending in force is usually a mistake. I don't know that that's really, that those are all together irrational.
Yeah, I don't think it's irrational. You know, I always like to say the first time you say from the river to the sea, you get a pass, and maybe the fifth time you get a pass. But you have to look at it from the from the perspective of the persons to whom it's addressed and how they view it. If you told me that I was using something that African Americans consider derogatory and threatening, I'd stop using it. But instead, they up the ante. And of course, there are, you know, stomping on Stars of David, go back to Poland. And one case, they said go back to the gas chambers and so forth. There are things that are quite threatening. The other thing I wanted to add is there's what's called a time, place, and manner. You may be able to do something on the quad that you can't do in the law library. You may be able to, vociferously protest the war in the Middle East, even on the pro-Hamas side of it. But you can't do it in every building, and you might not be able to do it in the president's office or in a residence hall where you're disturbing the people who are there. These time, place, and manner restrictions have been in the law for 100 years. And, my message today is have reasonable, neutral time, place, and manner rules and enforce them. And I'm not big on... I don't want to sit in the shoes of any president. I'm glad I'm not president of anything today. I think you have to be very careful about the use of force. You know, some people have said call out the National Guard. I don't believe that. I think I saw Kent State when I was, a student myself. And I think you have to handle this well. As far as I can see at Columbia, the New York Police Department handled it extremely well. There were no injuries. There were arrests. That was appropriate. We'll see what happens from here.
Yeah, I agree. Is anti-Semitism tolerated more in universities and establishment circles than racism or anti-gay bigotry?
I actually think to some extent it is. My organization, the Academic Engagement Network, works with diversity, equity, and inclusion officers. We probably met with 1,000 or 1,500. I have not given up on DEI as some groups have. But typically, diversity, equity, inclusion doesn't include Jewish people. They're viewed as privileged. They're viewed as white. They're overrepresented at many universities, overrepresented in terms of the relative share of the American population that Jews constitute. So I think, I tend to take a positive view. But let's try to have a broader umbrella when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and actually try to educate people as to what is offensive to Jewish people and as to what is viewed as anti-Semitic. Again, not by all Jews, and I'm not saying that at all, but most Jews view themselves as Zionists. They view Israel as part of the religious and historical and peoplehood legacy. And a lot of the DEI officers have just not been educated about that. So we try to give it a positive spin, and we've been successful in many universities in including Jewish people among those that you need to be aware of, whether they feel welcome or unwelcome, threatened or on campus or whatever.
Mark, before I turn it over to your friend, Paul Begala, one more question. Put on your hat as a former chancellor of two big university systems, and that's the role that fat cat donors play. At Penn, this is my view, a political opportunist, John Huntsman, and a private equity executive and big Trump donor, Mark Rowan, professing to be experts on bigotry, demanded the president be fired. I think she screwed up a lot, but I don't know what the grounds were. She certainly wasn't anti-Semitic. But more, a larger question, isn't that a slip most can determine academic policy?
Well, you know, I have to say I'm of two minds about it. You know, I don't like these, if I may say, crusades against sitting presidents, you know, I like it better when the board of trustees and the president and the faculty and so forth are primarily in charge of how things are governed on a university campus. On the other hand, people have, in my judgment, when you make a gift to an organization, if you think the March of Dimes has taken a wrong turn or all the good works the Shiner Hospital does, you, for some reason, think they, you know, they've gone amok somehow. I don't, by the way. I think they're not entitled to your money, and you can say that. And you can say, I'm not contributing anymore. And I heard from a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but some major donors to the University of Pennsylvania who were just infuriated. It's not the ones that you mentioned. So they don't have to give their money if they don't agree with how the place is being run and how Jewish students are being treated. To me, I really don't like the calls for resignations and so forth, but I understand them. But, you know, it's not something I would have pressed.
Well, yeah, I certainly agree. They're entitled to their money, but I think they misrepresented what happened there. But Paul Begala knows more than I do about all this. So go ahead, Paul, take over.
Well, all I know was taught to me by Mark Udoff. Our listeners should know he's been a mentor of mine all my adult life, when my dean in law school. The only reason I have a law degree is because of Mark.
We're not going to hold that against him, Paul.
Yeah. When did your adult life start, Paul? That's what I want to know.
That's a good question. About 6 months ago. Mark, I still want to call you Dean Udoff, but it's been a long time. You talked with Al a little bit about when to pull a trigger on, pardon, I shouldn't use that phrase, when you cross the line and bring in law enforcement and not the National Guard. I'm with you on that. It seems to me there's no easy, bright line. I think a lot of critics of Manoush Shafiq at Columbia believe she was too slow, allowed students to set up an encampment, which was seen as threatening to many Jewish students. Students felt unwelcome, Jewish students. On the other end, your beloved University of Texas, they hadn't even violated any laws that I know of. The county attorney they swept in with the DPS, not the UTPD, not the Austin PD, called the Department of Public Safety, and arrested 57 people. And the county attorney's like, I got nothing to prosecute them for. She turned them all loose right away because she believed, I think, that there was no reported physical injuries, no reported property damage. No reported trespassing. It's a public street and a public university. And yet, I know from my friends at UT, quite understandably, the president there doesn't want to see an encampment lasting weeks and weeks and disrupting commencement, disrupting classes the way that happened at Columbia. So where do you draw the line?
Well, you know, I don't know all the facts of Texas, so I guess I don't want to get into that. I draw the line when you're blocking entrance or exit from the campus, when you're harassing students, when you're holding, you know, if you held up a sign that said African Americans should go back to Africa, I think understandably black students would take offense at that, and the campus could say that this is not the sort of campus climate we want. And that's what I was talking to Paul about Title VI. There is a tension between freedom of expression under the First Amendment and the idea that the campus administration and the university is held responsible for the sort of campus climate it has for African-American students and Jewish students and so forth. There's no easy, but I would say that, you know, I'm an expert on demonstrations. I was president of the University of California. I had demonstrations everywhere. I had one campus that I never did visit because they insisted they didn't have enough cops to protect me. This is not just casual stuff. This is designed and intended to intimidate, not in all cases, but in many cases. And it has that effect on student life on the campus. I think occupying the library at Harvard and sitting in there and making a statement is wrong and shouldn't be tolerated. It might have been okay out, you know, in the Harvard yard, but it wasn't okay inside a library. So, I hate to use the word, because I got Liz McGill into a lot of trouble, but it is something that requires some understanding of the context in which it is uttered. Just like perjury is not, you know, forgiven because you have free speech rights, the context doesn't protect that speech, if indeed you have lied under oath. So, that's my take on it. You know, I've tried not to second guess any specific campus. I mean, UCLA had a. I've been watching CNN all day, which I rarely do when you're not on, Paul. I think you have a chief intelligence advisor or something like that, and he, I thought, was very thoughtful about what was happening at Columbia, why the police waited to go onto the campus, why they want the collaboration of the administration and all. That made a lot of sense to me. You have to painfully reconstruct these events to see ultimately whether, in my case, I would have made the same decision.
Well, I think you're right. You can't win for losing when you're in the position that you used to be in, or that the president of University of Texas or Columbia or UCLA, because you're either going to be too late or too early calling in law enforcement. You can't possibly win. And my heart does go out to those administrators. It does not go out to the students. I'm sorry. These are the most privileged people in America. And some of them are so effing ignorant. Ignorant. Go to one of those rallies and ask them, which river and what sea?
Yeah, someone did that. Wrote an editorial, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about it. Yeah, they don't know which river or which sea. They talk about the occupation of Gaza, but Israel ceded Gaza back to them, and they voted. What did they do? They voted in Hamas. And you know what? Right. There's not been an election since. Same thing is true, by the way, in the West Bank. Abbas has a 15-year or so, 4-year term. It's just woeful ignorance. And, you know, I hate to say, Paul, you may disagree with this, but there's sort of a progressive truth. You're anti-colonialist, which is fine with me, and you're anti-privilege and so forth. But it sweeps in, and it creates allies, which are extraordinary. I mean, would you rather be gay in Israel or rather be gay in Gaza or in Syria? It's not sensible. It's sort of a blind allegiance and a way of just dividing the world into the oppressed and the oppressors, and Israel's on the wrong side of the line. And by implication, Jews, and they're not always too steadfast about distinguishing between Zionists and Jews. While most Jews are Zionists, they're not all Zionists. In fact, some of them are having, you know, I suspect not many, but have participated in protest. The other thing I want to add, Paul, if I just may, big cities are a big problem. I don't know whether the mayor of New York is right about people coming in from the outside the campus, you know, not professors, not students, not staff, agitating about these things. But when you're in New York City and when you're in Boston and Philadelphia, these are big metropolitan areas, and it's undoubtedly the case that a significant measure of your problems are caused by people who are not members of your community.
I think that's a very good point, Mark, and I probably shouldn't have just slammed them all as students and ignorant. But I am struck, as somebody, as you know, I'm very pro-Israel and very progressive, very liberal, why the pro-Israel community, including myself, haven't made the case effectively that the liberal position is to be pro-Israel. You pointed out that Tel Aviv had 250,000 people at a gay pride parade. A country of 9 million, okay? They had 250,000 people in their gay pride parade. In Gaza, it's a crime to be gay.
Right.
There was a guy, Mahmoud Ishtuak, I can't remember his name, I'm sorry, I'm getting it wrong, but he was a Hamas military commander and gay, shot 3 times in the chest by his own men for the crime of being gay. Not for the crime of being a terrorist, but for the crime of being gay. Women in Gaza have no marital property rights. Period. The husband owns everything. Journalists are routinely beaten. If you'd had a protest in Gaza against the government, the way we have every day in America, you would be beaten. Torture was set up. But that Al-Shifa hospital became famous. There was unused parts of that hospital that Hamas had set up as torture chambers. How any liberal can get behind this. And I think it is, though, based on ignorance. And I say that because, you know, my wife, Nayan, she is on the scholarship committee. And one of the kids that got the scholarship is a Jewish young man from New York. And he moves to Austin. He's got he's a Zionist. He's got an Israeli flag like on his backpack or something. And she asked him how that's going. And he said, well, 4 or 5 kids came up. This is before the current crisis. 4 or 5 kids came up to me and started giving me static about Gaza and about. And I stopped and talked to them. This kid is way smarter than I am, because I would have harangued them and yelled at them and told them they were stupid. He said, are you familiar with Hamas and who they are and what they do? And they said, no. He said, just take a minute, look up Wikipedia, whatever you want. And 2 of the 5 right away said, oh my God, I can't get behind this group. Oh my God. They had no idea, no idea. And so I think you're right. I think a lot of young people are processing everything through this filter of oppressor and oppressed. And God knows Israel has 1,000 problems, nobody likes to see the loss of innocent life in Gaza. But I think some of these young people really don't have any idea that you know, Hamas is not Nelson Mandela.
Well, yes, I agree with you, and you know, it's ideology, it's alliances among groups, you know, like it. Berkeley Law at one point, you know, they didn't want to invite any pro-Zionist speakers, even if they were talking about insurance law. And it attracted, I mean, it's an alliance among these groups. And they, when it comes to the treatment of women, when it comes to homophobia and the like, you know, they sort of ignore what goes on. By the way, I have to say, this makes Jews so suspicious. It's one thing to say you don't like Chinese policy. It's another thing to say there shouldn't be a China. It's what, you know, you have 2.2% of the world's population in Israel, but there's no protest movement about Iran. I mean, there's none, or about Venezuela, or about any, you know, extreme right or left wing regime that is mistreating its people. None.
The Uyghurs, the largest country in the world, is putting Uyghurs in concentration camps. Burma is a terrible discrimination against the Rohingyas. There's a genocide in Darfur. None of this, for some reason, none of this gets the woke white left out to protest. Why do you suppose it's Israel?
Well, that's what makes so many Jews think it's anti-Semitic. You know, sometimes someone will say, and I believe this conceptually, there's a distinction between being anti-Israel or opposing Israeli policy or the BB government or whatever, and hating the Jewish people. But what you see is, a situation where almost every other country in the world gets a pass, and that have committed heinous crimes of all sorts in much larger numbers. You know, how many hundreds of thousands were slaughtered in Syria? Have you seen a protest about the Syrian government? I haven't seen it. And that is why maybe that many Jews feel that the line between being an anti-Zionist or critical of the Israeli government and being anti-Semitic may have been crossed. I mean, I'm just telling you how the listeners feel about the messaging they're seeing and the message being sent out on university campuses by these protesters. That's the way they see it. And I have to say, there's something to that. And you need to look at it from the standpoint not only of the speaker, I didn't intend, although I'm dubious about that, I didn't intend that. But, you know, it's like, you know, it's like saying I didn't intend to be racist when you make a racist comment. Who cares what you intended? This is what you said, and this is the effect on African-American people.
If I can, one last question before I get back to Al. Divestment. Okay, you were the chief officer of the University of Texas system, University of California system. Students are demanding divestment. Now, there's a rich history with this, right? I was one of the many students in the 80s calling for divestment from South Africa. The Cal system has divested from fossil fuels, or at least they say they have. But what does divestment look like with Israel? Some of the students are saying you can't even hold investments in Google and Microsoft, who they believe somehow are complicit in the situation in Israel. By the way, have those protesters stopped using Google and Microsoft?
What
does that look like? What if you were the administrator? The President Brown apparently has announced that I think it's a woman. She's going to have a vote on divestment and then defuse the crisis at Brown. So maybe there's something to this. Maybe we should all look at divestment. What does it look like though? As somebody who had to preside over those
it's
policies.
The answer is that it will fail. No university, this has been going on for 10, 15 years or more. No university in America has divested from investments in companies doing business with Israel. Not one has done that. The law has changed since the South African. There's decision. I hate to point out a Supreme Court case. You remember, Paul, that I used to keep secrets from you by putting them in law books and you'd never find them. But there is a Supreme Court case that effectively, in my opinion, says that if the State Department says it's okay to boycott a nation, then it's okay. But if they don't, they won't. And there are 30 states, including California. Jerry Brown signed a law which forbids government institutions, and I'm not sure whether it applies to just any university receiving funds. I think it does. Says you can't do it. So as a matter of law in 30 states, including red states and blue states like California and Texas, you're not allowed to do it. And I do think it's different, you know, because of its, impact on foreign relations and the fact that, you know, the federal government calls the shots on these things, and we have state laws on this, which, by the way, I don't know of state laws. Maybe there are some. I don't read law books anymore either, which would say, you know, if you're opposed to fossil fuels, you can't remove that from your portfolio. So I think this is a non-starter. And by the way, I think it's a make-weight. I mean, divestment is pretty far removed from the war in the Middle East. I mean, it just mm-hmm. is. It's not a step that furthers the Palestinian cause. And, you know, if something happens on the Temple Mount, there's a protest. If with Hezbollah launches rockets on Israel, there's a protest in support of Hezbollah. I don't delude myself. The real issue, it's symbolism, but it will never become a reality in America.
Albert?
I certainly agree with Paul that Hamas is no Nelson Mandela. Neither is Benjamin Netanyahu Winston Churchill. And I think my friend Jim Gerstein has done some great surveying both in here and finds that I think it's 90% of American Jews say you can be pro-Israel and against that government. And I abhor the excesses, but I also think that what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing is worthy of great protest, Mark. I mean, I think this is a guy who wants to keep his ass out of jail. And I think that's a view that a number of people in Israel, including probably Benny Gantz, hold right now. So I think it's, I, 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 think Hamas is just horrendous. But I don't think we then have to say, so therefore, the other side is, you know, a bunch of Jeffersonian Democrats.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I criticize Israel when I disagree with the policies. You'll never see anything out of my organization that says that we approve of this strategy in the war or we don't. You know, we stay out of it.
Uh-huh.
And you know, our contacts are mainly with universities over there. So I think that's right. And that you can be very critical of Bibi. You can think that they ought to have a different government, something for the Israelis to decide. You can question his motivations for why he does what he does. You know, one thing is going to happen in Israel, and you know, the way Israelis were caught off guard, apparently, and their intelligence failed, or at least someone was paying no attention to some of the intelligence. I mean, I think all that is worthy of investigation. So I don't know what else to say. I mean, I think, he has a lot of critics inside Israel. I mean, as you well know, and yep. I don't see the work of dealing with anti-Semitism and campus climate in America is dependent upon a Churchillian view of Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, so I agree with you.
You know, I have to tell just one story about campus demonstrations. At Duke, 50 years ago, the great Terry Sanford was president, and there were a huge group of demonstrators, and Terry went out and met with them. And they said, we're going to take over the administration building. And he said, go ahead. I've been trying to do that for 2 years. which I think, you know, communication, some of these leaders don't do a very good job communication. By the way, Terry was the one who ended Jewish quotas at Duke University, which had them up until the early 70s. So I think if we had more Terry Sanfords leading universities, you know, we might have less trouble.
Well, they try, but you know, you need someone on the other side who is willing to talk to you. I mean, I think one reading of the Columbia situation is the president made huge efforts to interact with them and to talk with them, but they don't want to talk. I mean, it really depends on the audience. My favorite, I have my story. You know, one of my predecessors at the University of Minnesota, they came to his house and were chanting, Free Mandela, Free Mandela, Free Mandela. He came out and said, I don't have him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think there is a way to so I obviously encourage them to talk, but if they, you know, I'm not sure the protesters at the University of Pennsylvania or at Columbia are in a talking mood. I mean, that's the nub of it. And you need two sides to have that dialogue, but I'm in favor of it. If a president can pull that off, and Sanford was a great president, and I think of, prior presidents at University of California and Notre Dame and other places, I think that's great. Talk to them and see if you can work through some of the issues and so forth. I'm not sure that you want to negotiate what your portfolio looks like.
I'm not either, but I think having, political as well as academic skills is useful for a university leader. And I think whoever is right or wrong, I think I know I'm not as convinced that the Columbia president, reached out as effectively as you suggest, though I may be wrong. But I just think the Terry Sanford example or analogy, I wish we had more.
But remember, these are different times. That's all I can say. And the rules of engagement seem to change. You know, when I was at Harvard during the Vietnam War, I never met anyone, faculty member, student, staff member, who was in favor of the war or the draft. The campus was not divided. It was not that sort of a problem. This is a conflict within the communities, within the faculty, within the student body, and so forth. It's very different. And these movements, look, in the old days, I never was a protester. I'm a peacenik, but they would carry signs carrying balsa wood. And then I discovered at the University of California, they were bringing more hardwood to that and using that occasionally to beat someone over the head. That's a difference in the tactic. So different tactics and a problem which is splitting the campuses in a way that Vietnam did not split the campuses. They were united and opposed to the administration's position.
Well, there were an awful lot of crazies in the Vietnam demonstrations, but you know what? They were right. They were right. The world's wrong. And, you know, for all their excesses.
Well, I opposed the war at the time. And you know, I don't make any bones about it. And but it's not sufficient to be right. It's how you conduct yourself. You know, and it was a free speech movement at Berkeley originally. And this is not a free speech movement. I mean, it just isn't. I mean, the same people who want diversity, equity, and inclusion have no trouble vilifying Jewish people on their campus. What sort of inclusion is that?
Well, let's talk about the academic engagement. Yeah, the academic engagement network. Mark, you were kind enough to, during COVID, to set up a Zoom where I met with many of your members. These are leading academics and university administrators. It seemed to me they're simply interested in a teaching moment, right? Again, I'm bitterly opposed to Netanyahu. I went to Israel and worked for his opponent, who's now the president of Israel, Bushi Herzog. But you learn something when you have to go and do that, right? And is there a way to bring those kind of academic values of free speech and honest debate into this? It doesn't mean that everybody will come out on the side that I'm on, and it may well be that there are important points, certainly are, on the other side. But how do you foster academic engagement? Not right now, because it's red hot. Okay, but so let's say we've the summer and things die out as kids go home, and in the fall, how do you make this a teaching moment? They used to have teach-ins during the Vietnam War, where people would actually learn about, like, where is Vietnam and why are we there? Is there any hope that you know, the problems of these protests can be cured with more free speech and academic engagement?
Well, you know, that is the whole premise of the Academic Engagement Network. We have 1,000 professors on 300 plus campuses across the country. And what we do is we do programs for DEI officers. We have a list of speakers that we send to the campus. We make grants to faculty members, mostly to address anti-Semitism on campus. And the whole premise of the organization is educational. That's what we do. We don't have people who protest and march into the president's office or any of that sort of stuff. It's all about, and frankly, there are now pro-Palestinian chapters of professors across the countries. There's the Students for Justice in Palestine. There's the Jewish Voices for Peace. You know, per se, unless they misbehave in the ways that we've talked about, you know, we're not saying they're not entitled to our voice, but we're trying to create alternative voices out there on the community that can engage the students and the faculty and the administrators. And I think that's coming along. I mean, I think of NYU, which has done a very good job on that sort of thing. And there are now a committee studying anti-Semitism. Our members either lead or are on many of those committees around the country. We provide them with information, with data points they might use. We haven't put it out yet formally, but we have a best practices document dealing with the issues you've raised, you know, time, place, and manner. What are real threats? You know, when is it that someone's saying, I hate Israel, which I don't like, but which is not per se, but which is probably protected. What are the types of things that are constraints that would apply depending on how they engage in this expression? So that was the hope of the organization. I wish it were a little less crazy than it is at the moment, but anyhow.
It's a source of great hope, though. I mean, it really is. It's the only way out of this. Someone once said, all of human history is a race between education and catastrophe.
That's right. What can I say? I'm a child of the Renaissance, or maybe Maimonides. You know, I always live in hope. I don't. I try not to give up on anyone, really, but certainly not the students who are protesting and the like. But when it interferes with the ability of Jewish students to feel safe and wanted on campus, I have a problem.
Well, that's a great way to end it, because I think we all should agree on that. And you have been very eloquent, Mark Udoff. We can't thank you enough. This is a heck of an issue. It's not going to go away, I'm afraid, but you have brought some light to it, and thank you.
Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seriously, your true wisdom. Thank you.
Hey, put your knowledge of current events to the test with Kalshi. You know how exciting it is to see the odds on everything from elections to weather events on Kalshi. You really can. Our listeners are current events junkies. We've said time and time again that you're some of the smartest and most informed people on the planet. Enter Kalshi, founded by two MIT engineers. Kalshi is the first legal financial exchange in the United States where you can bet on any event in all 50 states. It's like the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ for investing in the performance of events you know and care about. The exchange has hundreds of thousands of users with great trading volume, more than $500 million of trading and counting. Kalshi has company-related markets too, so you can make money betting on the factors that impact businesses most. You know, things like what inflation or interest rates will be, which countries will enter recession, or what Biden's approval will be in the future. For example, let's say you believe Biden's 538 approval rating will be over 40% at the end of the year. That's currently priced at 52%. I'm going to check with James Carville first, but meaning that the market thinks there's a 52% chance the position wins. So you can buy shares of Biden's approval rating being over 40% at 52 cents each. The price changes based on what market thinks the odds of the event are. So let's say you want to buy 100 shares. You pay 52 cents times 100, totaling $52. If his approval rating ends up over 40%, you win and you get $100, aka 100%. It can happen. If not, you get a zero, but you can sell your shares before the results come in. So if the share price goes to 80%, you can sell the 100 shares for 80 and make a profit before the event ends. Right now, you could also pick the other side for 48 cents if you want to hedge the chances that Biden ends the year lower than 40. Following the Kalshi markets gives you a great sense of what the likelihood of an event is. A price of 52 cents means thousands of people think Biden's approval rating will be over 40%. You can see the likelihood of all the events on Kalshi by checking the current market price, and Kalshi has many company-related markets to trade on right now. You can sign up using our link, Kalshi.com/politicswarroom for a $20 bonus on a deposit of $50 or more for the first 500 people who sign up there. That's KALSHI.com/politicswarroom. Again, Kalshi.com/politicswarroom for your $20 bonus on a $50 deposit. Now, you also can find the link in our show notes. Hey, now for the outrage of the week. Paul, I'm going to be a little bit grumpy, maybe more than a little bit. First, I'm not sure what useful functions either national parties play these days. Trump installed a whole new team at the RNC, including his daughter-in-law, Laura, who said they have suits on voting fraud in 81 states. Here's that, 81 states. Now, there, of course, are only 50. But then again, this has nothing to do with voter fraud, of which there is precious little in America. It's about voter suppression or voter intimidation. So if you have a fraudulent program, you might as well use fraudulent data, Laura. That's fine. Now, I'm also not terribly high on the DNC, but the other day it warned that if Donald Trump is elected, it could mean the end of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Now, I know of at least 87 reasons why Donald Trump should not be elected. The fate of the White House Correspondents' Dinner didn't even make the cutting room floor. That dinner has little to do with the press, White House, or otherwise. I actually have been, to show you what an old guy I am, to 33 or 34 of these. The first half, it used to be okay, mainly journalists taking an interesting and important source for a dinner where booze flowed. But one of my pleasures is that now we have, it's more about glitterati and special interest and lobbying, which is fine, but I don't like going, so I don't have to go anymore. And I think if you have these dinners, it's terrific, but let's not pretend that it has anything to do with the press. And I'm sorry, DNC, it's not one of the great casualties if Donald Trump is elected. I didn't go this week, but I did watch the humorous speech of Saturday Night Live's Colin Jost, and the New York Times is dead wrong. He was terrific at the event, and it's worth watching on YouTube. Paul.
I'm with you on Colin Jost, and I'm even more negative on that dinner. I went, of course, I worked for President Clinton, and he was, he was a good sport, and I thought reasonably funny. I peaked in 2011. I saw Barack Obama eviscerate Donald Trump. I was there. I was, and then not knowing, of course, no one did, that he'd already given the order to capture or kill Osama bin Laden.
Right. And he was as cool as he could
be. Than that.
Right.
It was amazing. So I have no interest in going again. In fact, if Trump's election causes the demise of that dinner, that might be at least one reason to vote for Mr. Trump. It's a waste of time.
Paul, do you have anything that particularly outrages you, or you want to just stick with that?
I do. I do. No, Al, you know how I love Texas. And I've been all over Texas. And if you go up in the high plains of Panhandle, which is about as far from my part of Texas as you can get, hundreds of miles away, but there's these great little towns with names like New Deal and Idaloo and Leveland and Muleshoe. And they're really tough people. These are really independent people. They're very conservative politically. Man, they don't want the government to tell them what to do. But several of the counties up there, Lubbock County, which is a big town, home of Texas Tech, several others, the city of Odessa, are passing ordinances criminalizing driving through their town if you need to get an abortion. So can you imagine Kate Cox from Texas, right, who had she wanted a third baby. The baby had a fatal fetal abnormality, and carrying it to term would have risked her life, her doctor said. She had to leave Texas to get the medically required abortion care she needed. If you're driving through the high plains, by the way, if you're sitting in Amarillo, you're 250 miles from the nearest abortion clinic in Santa Fe. So you're driving through there. Can you imagine the cops pulling you over? They're not going to pull over guys that look like you and me. They're going to pull over young people, especially young women. And it's, to me, it is as terrible and tragic an outrage. It is literally un-American. It's very un-Texan for the government to be pulling you over and saying, what are you doing in this car, ma'am, and where are you going and why? So I think that is truly tragic and truly outrageous.
It is, and sadly, it is a reflection of what your wonderful state politically has become. There were Republicans when I was covering politics many years ago, John Tower, Bill Clements, certainly George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, who you might not have agreed with, but you had a certain respect for. Now you have nothing but a bunch of crooks and clowns. And Paul, I was so taken by the fact that Ken Paxton, your legally, criminally, ethically challenged attorney general, was at the Trump trial the other day. And I thought, how fitting that Mr. Paxton gets to see what it's like on the inside of a courtroom, because he may be there someday.
Well, the people of Texas, you know what they need to do? They need to vote. You know, Texas is almost always 49th in voter turnout. Yes, Texas is a red state, but even more than that, it's a non-voting state. So if you want to protect women like Kate Cox, by the way, the people of Amarillo may well be voting on a similar travel ban in their city this year, that the city council is contemplating passing one or maybe handing it off to the voters. But people turn out and vote. I think they'd have a completely different result there. They have a very hot senator.
And they got a great candidate, don't they, Paul? I mean, Colin, you know, people talk to you about Beto O'Rourke, and I'll tell you from my vantage point, Colin Allred is a better candidate than Beto O'Rourke.
I was instructed by Nancy Pelosi in 2018 to get my ass to Texas and go meet Colin and campaign with him, and I did. And he is a remarkable guy. The short bio of Colin is three words. Jesus Mama Football. Okay, he's a person.
It's a pretty good combination.
That's not bad in Texas. Jesus Mama Football. That ought to be a slogan.
Yeah,
he's a man of profound faith. was raised by a single mom who was really heroic. He got into sports and football, played at Baylor, tragically, and then as an undersized linebacker, made it and played in the NFL. He went on to get a law degree, and he's a very impressive civil rights lawyer, and now he's a congressman. I mean, he is everything I think a Texan ought to be and everything Texans ought to admire in a potential senator. And Ted Cruz, you know, as we say back home, God love him. Bless his heart.
He needs someone to, so I guess we'll give that duty to God. You know, I call.
Well, that's the whole joke. He worked in the Bush campaign, George W. Bush, and one of Bush's people, this joke had been around a long time, said that Ted came to him at one point and says, "Why did you take such an instant dislike to me?" And the guy said, "Well, Ted, it saves time."
I'll tell you two quick stories, Paul, because your encyclopedic knowledge of Texas overwhelms. But I went up one time with President Kennedy's grandson to present a Profound Courage Award to George H.W. Bush, who was up in Kennebunkport. He couldn't come to the dinner. And he just charmed young Jack Schlossberg. And I talked to Barbara Bush for about 45 minutes. And Jack may have learned more. I may have had more fun. One of the stories she told me was, I'm the gatekeeper. People come to see me if they want to see George. And I usually say, okay, we set it up. Ted Cruz called the other day. I said no. That was it. Colin Allred, after the 18 election, I called some of those new members because I hadn't been out as much as I would like to have. And he called back the next day and he said, "I'm sorry I couldn't call back yesterday, but I was seeing a constituent." And I said, "Who?" He said, "I was over talking to George W. Bush." I thought, that's pretty good. A new Democratic congressman going talking to the former president of the United States, who I bet you in the sanctity of his ballot box, which we'll never know, will pull the Allred lever.
Yeah, people should look at what he did. He represents one of the wealthiest and not at all minority. He's a black man. His district is white. My niece, Grace Begala, full disclosure, worked for Colin in that campaign. And she would tell me about going door to door for this guy. And it says people like to ding Texas. It says a lot about the people of Dallas County that they picked a guy like Colin Allred to represent a former president like George W. Bush.
Boy, it sure does. All right, we're into full disclosure. If you're up in New York, I got a race in New York 4 that is one of those toss-up races where a certain son of mine that you gambled with one time when he was only a teenager with. So, you know, stop by Rockville Center. They could use your help up there, Paul.
On my way.
All right. Total Gym gives you everything you need for a great workout at home. How convenient is it to have a Total Gym at home when life gets pretty busy, as it does for you?
I am rehabbing a knee, and I go to physical therapy for it. If I could do that at home, it'd be great.
Well, it is terrific because we actually have one. You know, it is tough to find time to go to the gym. You know how much easier everyone benefits from a home workout. But finding a system is not easy. Finally, we discovered a convenient home workout with Total Gym. If you want a total body workout in just 10 to 20 minutes, you need a Total Gym. Right now, you can try Total Gym for 30 days for just $1 plus free shipping. Seriously, $1. The Total Gym Fit, Total Gym's newest model, lets you do over 85 exercises in one home gym. Never get bored working out again. Total Gym accommodates all fitness levels from ages 8 to 80 plus. You know, that's what they say, but I have a 6-year-old grandson who really loves it. So maybe he's not supposed to do it to his 8, but he's precocious. Literally, anyone listening to this will enjoy the Total Gym. It works out multiple muscle groups simultaneously. So 60 plus minutes becomes only 10 to 20. I got a great full body session. After breakfast, you work up a sweat in only 15 minutes. So that gives me plenty of time to prepare for James Carville, usually. I hit my legs, core, chest, and everything in between. You feel so much more energized and know Total Gym is going to improve your life too. So Total Gym works by using a percent of your body as resistance. Setting the resistance level higher builds muscle. Setting it lower tones and slenders. The unique design allows you to easily move from exercise to another without having to add or remove weights. That means you can do strength training, cardio, and stretching all on one machine. There's no assembly required, and it sets up in minutes. Plus, it folds conveniently for storage. I know you're going to feel great every time you use it. Forget fitness fads. Get results. Remember, it only takes 10 to 20 minutes a day to reshape your body. Head to TotalGymDirect.com/warroom for an additional 20% off your order. Plus, that includes a free ab crunch attachment and free shipping. Please note that War Room is in all lowercase. This special offer won't be available for a lot longer. So that's TotalGymDirect.com/warroom for an additional 20% off. And make sure you go to our URL, TotalGymDirect.com/warroom, all lowercase, so they know we sent you. You can find the link in our show notes. And now for our listener questions, Paul. We have such informed, smart listeners. They really, really do challenge us every week in such a productive way. The first is from Brian in Thousand Oaks, California. And he says, I mean, you picked up on this earlier, but is Florida state for the Biden campaign to put more focus on? With so many Cubans living there, does it make sense to remind them of how it was living under an autocrat? Good way to put it, Brian.
Yes. Cubans, Venezuelans, who, of course, fleeing a terrible dictatorship down there. Yes, yes, yes. And this new stringent and cruel abortion ban that Florida has enacted. Citizens in Florida have the opportunity to take back their state. And if I were Biden's campaign, I'd send money down there for sure and advertise heavily.
The abortion is on the ballot, but it requires 60% to win, which actually is good for turnout. That's saying, man, it really matters. Don't assume this thing's going to pass. You got to do something Ohio and Kansas and other places couldn't do. You got to get to 60%. And they got a shot, Paul.
They do. They do. I think that folks are really tired in Florida of the kind of ultra extremist governance that they're getting. And I think they want to go back to the sensible center.
Yeah. Next is Tom in Vancouver, Washington, who asked, how will Trump's trial play out in the more important court of public opinion? Normally, a campaign wouldn't want their candidates in a porn star hush money trial. Clearly not normal. Tim, I thought that when he, made fun of John McCain and insulted John McCain as a war hero, I thought that would be devastating for him. I thought when the Access Hollywood tape came out, it was all over. That was it. The election was done. I thought when he went and his first impeachment, he shook down a foreign leader in order to dig up dirt about an opponent. I thought, my God, no, I can't imagine anyone doing that. And then I thought January 6th, that absolutely is the end. So I've got a pretty bad track record, and I'm really not sure. My gut tells me that if he is criminally convicted, that will make a little bit of a difference. But I've been wrong so often before. Paul?
You know, I actually am not sure that the conviction will have any effect. But you know what is? The process. Trump's supporters see him as a strong man. And particularly because of Biden's age, they see Biden as weak and infirm. Biden has done a terrific job of mocking Trump, of ridiculing him for being old, fat, weak, sleepy, gassy. Good God, Carvel is like cornered the market on fart jokes about Donald Trump. This is something his supporters can't bear. Like whenever I go on TV and say, oh, he wants to be a dictator on day one, his people love hearing that. But if you say, you know, he's just kind of pathetic, I feel sorry for the guy. You know, finally, a week into the trial, one of his kids showed up for one of the sessions. Like his own family, Jeffrey Dahmer's family came to his trial. I mean, the guy is pathetic. He's a loser. He's sleepy. He's out of gas. He's weak. He's literally out of gas. But I think that picture of this guy as deflated is hurting him.
I hope so. I think you may be right, but I hope so. Jeff in San Francisco says, having two Supreme Court seats hijacked by the Republicans and blockages galore by McConnell and other Republicans, why don't we simply let Speaker Johnson walk the plank? why would a Democrat vote for someone other than Jeffries for Speaker? This is if there's a motion to vacate the chair by Marjorie Taylor Greene. Should Democrats help Mike Johnson?
Yeah, I think they should, actually. Johnson is probably even more conservative than Kevin McCarthy, who got absolutely no Democratic support.
That's because Kevin McCarthy had no beliefs.
That's the thing, Al. I called, when that was going on, I literally called some of the most liberal members of the Congress and the Democratic Party, some of the most moderate. They all said the same thing. They didn't say Kevin's too conservative for me. They all said he's a liar. And as you know, you've covered the Hill. I've worked on the Hill. The coin of the realm is that you keep your word.
Absolutely.
And Democrats believed, I think fairly, that McCarthy was a liar. They think Johnson's ultra conservative, but he hadn't lied to them. And he did pass this Rearming America bill, right? That will build more tanks in Lima, Ohio, and more ATACMS missiles in Arkansas, which we then can send the old ones to Ukraine that they can use to defend themselves against Putin's invasion. So I think that's been a terrific law. And I would never call it foreign aid. It's not foreign aid. It's Rearming America. And I salute Johnson for doing that. And I think he is, I think that the country needs some stability there. And even though I don't agree with him on 95% of the issues, I think Democrats are right to say they'll step in and save him this time.
Yeah, you don't unseat a guy after he's done a good and a pretty courageous thing. I mean, that just stands in eye. And moreover, if Hakeem Jeffries does that, and I said if it comes to a vote, I'm pretty sure he will, it's going to drive the crazies crazier. I mean, it really is. Can you just imagine Boebert and Green and Chip Roy and all the others? Oh, my God. So it's worth
Paul
doing.
Paul Gosar of Arizona has already weighed in, wants to remove Johnson.
Anyway, okay. Randall, and boy, my wife was born in Oklahoma. I better get this right. Maybe you know. Supalupa, Oklahoma. Do you know that? S-U-P-U-L-P-A? I don't know, Judy. I'm sorry. But she was born in Tulsa. Would Democrats in Washington accept defeat if Trump does defeat Biden in the Electoral College, but not the popular vote in November? The answer is yes. We've already done it. 2000. Remember, Al Gore won. He not only won the popular vote, he probably got cheated out of Florida. And other than a few strays, led by a really eloquent speech that Al Gore gave on December 13th, Democrats accepted it. That's what you do. There have been other elections like that. The only person in American history that I'm aware of that doesn't believe that the actual votes matter, that you contest it, is Donald J. Trump, who to this day has never conceded that he lost in 2020. He lost clearly. He is a loser.
Yeah, there's only been 5 times in American history where the popular vote was different from the electoral vote. The problem is twice, 2 of those 5 times happened in the last 24 years. Mm-hmm. And in both times, Al Gore and Hillary Clinton were patriots. I think Gore clearly was cheated by the Supreme Court. Hillary was not. She was cheated by Jim Comey. But Hillary lost fair and square. Gore, I think, lost because of the intervention of the Supreme Court. But both of them stepped up and said, even though they were the choice of the American people, that's not how the system works because of this damnable electoral college. And they went along with it. And this will happen again for the Democrats. But interestingly, in his interview with Time magazine, Mr. Trump once more refused to say he would peacefully and honorably acknowledge if and when he is defeated again.
Paul, he even has said he doesn't want to appoint anyone who doesn't acknowledge that the 2020 election was stolen. So therefore, he just wants a bunch of liars in his administration. I suppose that's fitting. It's remarkable. This question has to go to you. It's Mike in a little town I think you've heard of called Austin, Texas, the home of Paul Begala and my wonderful assistant, LL, as in Longhorn Lefty Carter. The question is, why do we keep hearing Trump being treated like any other criminal defendant while he keeps pissing on gag orders? Is there a fear that sanctions would help his campaign?
I don't know is the honest answer. People say that people who are covering this, particularly at CNN where I work, say that this judge is squared away and completely fair. And it may well be that for the first offense of violating a gag order, you don't go to jail, but you pay a fine. And I'm fine with the way that this judge is handling Mr. Trump. It is true that he is treated better than almost any of the rest of us would be. I don't think by this judge, but by the system itself, that Trump is getting, I think, pretty favorable treatment, to tell you the truth. But ultimately, I'm not going to second guess the judge for making a call that that judge has probably made dozens of times.
No, I hear the same thing about this judge, Paul. John in Chicago, Illinois, says Republicans that speak out against Trump are getting primaried. What happened to all the conservative Ronald Reagan Republicans that could help fund candidates that, so they could beat the MAGA cult? You know what? They're the same place that the former President Reagan is. They're mainly dead. It's a party that Trump has totally taken over like nothing we've ever seen. FDR did not dominate the Democratic Party, even the way Trump dominates the Republican Party. There are outliers. I would advise anyone out there who doesn't subscribe to the Bulwark or doesn't listen to the former Charlie Sykes or Bill Kristol and Tim Miller and Sarah. I mean, it is
Sarah Longwell.
Sharon. It's a very worthwhile site. They are former Republicans and maybe current Republicans. They know the party, they know the man, and they are unremitting in their criticisms on Trump. And I don't hold on. The party's caved, Paul. It's just totally, totally caved. People who know better have caved. And I'm seeing that. I mean, I was infuriated by Jamie Dimon's comments over in Davos, basically saying, hey, you know, it was, you know, not a bad president. Doesn't really make much difference. Yes, it does, Jamie. The rule of law protects your bank.
Yeah, I, of course, I'm not a Republican, but my old man was, my late father, my late stepfather, and they would not recognize this party today. They believed that Republicans stood for limited government, strong national defense, America leading the world, and family values. Did anybody with a straight face say Trump stands for any of those things? So I've been astonished and shocked at how the business community especially has just, they're so cowed by Trump, you can hear him move.
Well, the great Lou Cannon, Reagan's biographer, says that Reagan would be horrified by Donald Trump. I think he would. We just have one more, and we'll finish it. It's Jeff in St. Pete, who he wants to ask you, Paul Begala, inflation is poison to an incumbent. Biden has allowed the MAGAs to dominate on immigration. His campaign team seems to be punting on second down. This is without accounting for third parties. Give me some optimism, Jeff says. Paul?
I can give you optimism. Go into the Politics War Room archives and find the interview that Al and James did with Bob Casey, the senator from Pennsylvania. He is dialed in on cost of living. Carville's rule, never call it inflation. Dialed in on cost of living. He's got a tough race in a swing state, and he is talking about shrinkflation and greedflation, how corporations are ripping you off. That you know, this is, I think he's really onto something powerful here. It's so powerful that Joe Biden cited him by name in the State of the Union address.
Absolutely.
Democrats can fight back on cost of living. Mr. Trump wants to raise the cost of your insulin. He wants to raise the cost of your prescription drugs. God knows what kind of deals he's cutting with the Saudis, who have such control over the price of gas. He has them come play their stupid tournaments at his pathetic golf courses. So, yeah, I think Democrats ought to listen to Bob Casey and fight back on cost of living and show that they're actually on the side of reducing your cost of living, and Mr. Trump wants to raise it.
Well, that's very good advice, and I want everybody to send any, if I didn't get to your questions today, make sure you send them in next week. One particularly, Kathy in McKinney, Texas, has one for James. And I'm not going to do it this week, but Kathy, send it in for next week. Thank you. We love those questions. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with guest host Paul Begala. And I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Ladder, Kalshi, and Total Gym in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another program as we continue our War Room planning.